I would like to turn to your scholarship in the world of sports.
Okay.
You have written quite extensively on sports, and I'd be very interested in your opinion about the way its importance in American society. Mm-hmm. And I know you're speaking tonight on the vile nature of fandom.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fascinating title. I imagine there are a lot of people who aren't going to be able to go to this event, so who might only hear what you have to say on this podcast. So I'd invite you to explain what you have in mind.
Sure. Again, just like all my work and actually my whole being is all about a comparison of Europe and the United States. And my research on sports started on an American boat on the Danube, but this is a long story. And it is a story, it's a very autobiographical one, because I grew up with European football and American sports, and I'm a passionate, I follow all of it constantly, it's my life.
It's a good thing you're at the University of Michigan. You
exactly.
have an opportunity to do that.
No question. One of the reasons why I accepted the offer was precisely that it actually combines that. And I go to almost every Michigan home game, of course, in football, basketball, on and on and on. Track. So the story about the sports is that I look at why America developed its own sports and not what became popular everywhere else, namely, of course, soccer.
Oh, I thought you meant cricket.
No, because cricket actually is very confined.
Yeah.
Cricket is only the English...
No, I was being facetious.
Yeah, no, but it could have been. But cricket, by the way, if you look at the
in
numbers...
In the Raj, it's important.
No, but the numbers are huge because, of course, they include India, which is 1.5 billion people.
Mm-hmm.
But so cricket, no, not cricket. In this case, association football called soccer... with an English slang word. Actually, it's not an American term. By the way, the anti-Americanism there is also a whole story which I can't go into because we don't have the time. But so I actually wanted to, my first book looked at why Americans didn't develop soccer as a hegemonic sports culture. And it was very much linked to the fact of what I just discussed before, that America is the first bourgeois society. We are the first to create our own culture. Which basically baseball existed already in all its networks and organizations by the time soccer was exported from England.
Mm-hmm.
And a cousin to soccer, what became American football.
Mm-hmm.
Out of rugby, it became American football. Blame it all on Harvard. It's a great article. Without Harvard, it would be rugby. But
that's funny. I thought the first college football game was between
Rutgers and Princeton
and my alma mater, Rutgers.
Correct. On November 15, 1869. And they basically played a soccer-like game.
Oh, interesting.
And Harvard then refused to join that league. And Harvard remained steadfast to actually play something else. And in 1874, they fall in love with rugby and McGill. And it's and Harvard's panache and charisma leads then by 1877 and 1878 to it become ultimately what football is today. So hence, blame it all on Harvard. If
done.
You're a soccer fan.
Done.
Done. Okay, so basically, again, here too, there are two different publics that arise historically. And they create their own sports culture. In America, it's basically much more, it's a franchise system, it's a business mm-hmm. system on the professional level. And then, of course, it's the only country in the world that has college sports. This doesn't exist anywhere
right.
else. I mean, there are university teams here and there, but this notion.
Club teams.
Club
they?
Teams, whatever. But,
yeah.
you know, the big house, the second biggest, stadium in the world, you know, filling every Saturday in Ann Arbor with 114,000 people. And this whole thing is actually uniquely American.
Mm-hmm.
And I explain why college sports arose only in America, which has everything to do with American higher education being much more market-based and much more society-based rather than state-based
mm-hmm.
and rather than central church or authority-based. Back to the old feudalism issue. I'm just published an article, or it's coming out, I think, the next few days, of why Americans are the only ones who hate ties or draws. Why do American sports fans detest ties? And they do because in a culture that is highly capitalist, that needs, doesn't have aristocratic certainty. It needs winners and losers. Americans cannot handle the uncertainty of winning or losing. If you're a British aristocrat, it's not a problem. You play 5-day cricket games, which almost always end in a draw. Okay, mm-hmm. Doesn't matter. Okay, you've won already. It doesn't, mm-hmm. Winning is not a problem. In this society, in capitalism, it's very important. It's winning or losing. There's no in-between. So this actually creates a different kind of sports culture. I talk about that in my publications and look at why, you know, the college sports, which is one of the chapters, and including, by the way, the role of women. We could talk about that also.
Today's
lecture in the evening, I will argue that all fandom is actually nasty and tribal. Mm-hmm. But the epitome of it has been attained in contemporary Europe, which in many ways is a much more less violent and much more civilized, quote-unquote, place than the United States, but not in soccer stadiums.
Is that kind of fandom harmless?
Oh, it's certainly not harmless. It's brutal. It's racist. It's anti-Semitic. It's violent. It's vile. And the question is why. So I'm not going to reveal my answer here. But why in Europe has fandom of this particular game developed an acuity which is actually disgusting, and where in fact
hooliganism, fandom, I think, is the,
well,
the,
hooliganism
the
is
Russians call it.
Right. Hooliganism, and then which starts in the 1970s England, but it actually is Europe wide. Italy is horrible, Poland, all of it. Mm-hmm. And why this happened. So that's what the topic is tonight.
But that isn't the nature of fandom in the United States.
No,
though.
Nature.
We don't have the reputation.
No, we don't. I mean, not that there isn't some violence. And by the way, only typically in rivalry games. Okay, it's right because
and it's usually alcohol fueled.
Yeah. But clearly there is some violence, but you don't have any. And there are lots of reasons for that. Again, the role of college sports, which meant that actually women went to games much earlier. There are many more women in American stadiums than in Europe soccer stadiums. And women
got
as
to
we,
have a civilizing effect.
Boy, absolutely. As they say, women are civilizing agents. And as Huck Finn worried about this, actually, in his beautiful, when he says civilizing, I forgot now the woman's name,
Becky.
Becky, and he actually writes it with an S, civilizing. Yeah, so we men, even though are should be grateful for this, oftentimes we're not. And my argument to come to the punchline about tonight is that the soccer stadium in Europe has remained the bastion of unmitigated maleness. Mm-hmm. It's the last place where European men can behave like lunatics and be rewarded for it by their pals, who they are, and they actually kind of portray themselves as kind of being authentic working class, which of course they're not. So what if I had infinite amount of money, which I would love to have for all kinds of other research, I would love to have students follow these football hooligans or soccer hooligans to their jobs on Monday morning. And my hypothesis is that they're not miners or dockers or workers, whatever, that these are
office
bankers.
Workers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And who actually then for 2 hours a week become lunatics and are rewarded for it and can be racist that they can't be in anything else in Europe in good society. Europe is becoming, you know, just, you know, it's you know, EU, it's everything has to be
right.
Politically correct, whatever. But here they actually can behave any which way they want under the guise of authenticity. So that's the punchline of the lecture.
Well, if we turn toward women's sports in particular,
yes,
that doesn't seem to be
a
problem there at all.
Thank God.
Thank God, and thank God for Title IX.
Right.
So do you want to talk about women's sports?
Yeah, of course I will. I mean, it's been preoccupying me for decades. It's not violent because ultimately it doesn't matter yet. Okay, people, it's not like Ohio State, Michigan. Okay, it's not the anger.
Even if it is Ohio State, Michigan.
Yeah, Ohio State, Michigan is wonderful. Actually, I go to these. OK, okay? Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful. You go and you fraternize and it's lovely and it's just, because ultimately it doesn't matter. And all, yet, in terms of its history, in terms of its acuity, in terms of...
The money that's at stake.
Yeah, it's not even money. It's not money. Uh-huh. That's not why these fans are beating each other up. It's about, look, ultimately, fandom is an extension of yourself. And what happens, there's lots of research on this in social psychology. And if you were a real fan, you think that Michigan football is about you, or Ohio State football, mm-hmm. or Manchester United, okay? Iowa, there you go, Iowa, you know, Hawkeye, you know, you're, this is it. There's no, you can't compromise mm-hmm. on this. There's no, it's not, you know, it's not interest group politics. It exists or it doesn't.
Yeah.
And the more, the less tolerant it is, the more authentic it purports to be. Mm-hmm. Last week, a student of mine came to the office and he said, you know, Professor Markowitz, I have to stop being a Michigan fan anymore. I can't be. And I actually know why. He's British. And I said, yeah, I know it's not violent enough for you. I said, yeah. I go and people are laughing. People are having a good time. You know, I go to the Auditron and they're laughing. I don't like fans who laugh. You don't laugh. You fight.
It's serious.
You are angry. You are vicious. Mm-hmm. I knew this, that, you know.
Yeah.
See, I understand. He's a Chelsea fan.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, travels with Chelsea, and when they play Man United, there's no laughter. Okay, this
yeah.
is serious business. So back to women, nowhere near this. Hopefully it never will get to that. Women are, it's a fascinating story because women on the side of sports doing, in other words, rather than following, these are two different things,
mm-hmm.
have drawn level with men and totally by dint of Title IX in the United States and by similar reforms in Western Europe. And they are now playing and follow, I mean, have leagues on and on and on. Where it's different still is on the following stage.
Mm-hmm.
To women, again, maybe, thank goodness, okay? I have a five grading form of being a fan. Awareness, allegiance, awareness, acceptance, allegiance, and the fourth is joining. Also with an A, but I actually added a fifth one, which is what I call, it's a form of affliction. And with women, actually, that does not exist yet.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, women are fans, and I did a study on the women are fans of a team. They follow it. They are passionate. They know it. And then it's over. Okay, it's not.
I was an afflicted Red Sox fan for decades, so I understand that term.
I actually should stop the interview right now. afflicted Red Sox fan. I will never forget the beer that was poured on me with my Yankee cap and the bleachers in the Red Sox.
Oh, you should see what happens to me when I go to Yankee
exactly,
Stadium.
Exactly. So there we. This is actually we got to the closest American rivalry. That is closest to European rivalries. Actually, the one that actually is even more acute and actually nasty than Red Sox Yankees is, you might remember, Giants Dodgers. From the old New York days.
So they moved.
Yes, no, but it's still,
mm-hmm.
okay? It's still a more acute angry form of
rivalry. Well, it's worse for me because my wife's a Yankees fan and I'm a Red Sox fan, so, you know, sometimes mixed marriage works.
Yeah, I don't know how this works. I have nothing to say about that.
So, all right. We've got a few minutes left, Professor. I'd like to talk about your biography and the fact that you were born and grew up in Europe and came here as a young man.
First as a young boy, but then as
a young boy. And so that also gives you a perspective on the United States that's different. And I wonder if you could share some of the things you were talking about this morning with my students about how you fell in love with America and what is it about America that you would like those of us who don't necessarily think about it that way to appreciate.
Well, I mean, there was the Grand America, which I heard about as a kid in Romania, you know, but I knew nothing of. And in fact, the first time I ever heard about America was on at a very famous final soccer match in the World Cup in 1954 between Germany, West Germany and Hungary. And my father and I were listening to the Hungarian radio, and the Hungarians lost this game, which was one of the biggest upsets ever. And the radio announcer was crying on the radio because we listened to Radio Budapest. And my father just turned to me. I was 6 years old. My father turned to me and said, "The only thing that matters to you in this," because I noticed that he was not particularly upset either by the Hungarian loss or the German win. I mean, Nazi victimized, Holocaust-ravaged parents. And he turned to me and he said, "The only thing that's important here is that this was played on the 4th of July, which is the birthday of the United States." And I remember, wow, the first time I've heard the word Americans, birthday of the United, what is this? And I will never forget that, ever. And so clearly, and he was right. I mean, it became so important to me years later. And so that was America. I mean, some birthday on a football match in Bern, Switzerland, where, so it was clearly this ethereal something that is distant and ultimately good and will be good to you. And then when we arrived in 1960, as I told you, students, the immigration officer, I will never forget it, okay? An immigration officer, open white shirt, white high T-shirt, which was very American. Europeans never wore T-shirts that high, and I always, since then, always wear T-shirts that are visible, always. And he had a name tag, some Italian name, Mangione or whatever. He chewed gum, bubble gum, unbelievable. Blue bubbles. Here is an authority figure who rules over life and death, because my father said, he held on to me, and we have to get it. You don't know what this is. I mean, and this is a guy who actually blew bubbles and kind of chewed gum, listened to some baseball game on his little transistor radio. And that, to me, was America. And then the cab with my uncle into New York, African-American driver, oval steering wheel, wicked good rock and roll station on the AM radio, open window, Triborough Bridge, the wind, sun, end of story. The best, okay? It was basically just a form of, it's a kind of an acculturation, which was then sort of, and then the Yankees later, but then it became a sort of what political scientists like to call path dependent. It's like a train, something actually enters into on a track. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very difficult to dislodge something from a track. Well, to me, it always goes back to that day in 1960, June, when we arrived in the United States, met this Italian guy who, you know, was the officer. And then I fell in love with New York. It's a lasting love affair. And that's America, with all its horrors and warts. But to me, it was ultimately... gave me an immensely rewarding life. I would have never, ever become anything close to this that I am in the United States. Let me put it this way. I would never, ever have become the equivalent world-famous professor. No.
Your merits as a scholar would not have been appreciated in the way that they are here?
I don't even know that. I don't think I even would have been a scholar in the same way. I just don't know. It's very clear that, to me, the hindrances, including, by the way, the micro-hindrances of my family, I think I would have never been able to overcome my father better than being distant and being in New York and Columbia. And so there's a lot of confluences, 1968, and lots of things that to me are America, which have a lot to do with the distance from Europe, which was to me kind of this strict, much more rigid world, and which may not be the same for someone else, and may not be the same today. I mean, I hated going back to my high school, and I did, a couple of years ago when I was in Vienna, and it's obviously a very different place. It's not this repressive. It's the first of all, it has girls in it.
Yeah.
Okay. The director is a woman. I mean, it's a different world. But
right.
To me, it would always be this nasty sort of punishing.
Mm-hmm.
I was very good in Latin. Our Latin teacher, he for some reason hated me, and every Monday morning, he quizzed me with Latin verbs and then also Latin words. And if I didn't know one, I was punished in some ways. And today we would call this abuse. I mean,
it was.
Yeah, no question. Mm-hmm. People then later asked, was he anti-Semitic? I have no idea. But the point is that it happened to me. So to me, this is the Europe that I escaped. I'm sure there were many, many other Europes that exist as well.
Well, you came to the United States in 1960, you've told us. I wonder, since we are in Charleston and it's such an important part of our history and the Southern history, what observations would you make about the civil rights struggle?
And huge. To me, the civil rights struggle became very important because the synagogue that it went to in New York occasionally talked about Andy Schwerner and, you know, these Jewish guys who actually were freedom riders.
Goodman,
and so on.
Schwerner, Jewish. Cheney.
Exactly. Good for you. And so it kind of existed in some fashion. I also think it was immensely sort of exculpatory because it was the evil South and somehow the wonderfully exonerated, completely moral North. But yes, it played an important role as well. And I remember it was very traumatic for me in some ways in 1968, the Columbia Uprising, when CORE and the African American students took over Hamilton Hall and asked the whites to leave.
Mm.
And
you were their ally.
Exactly. Good for you. Exactly. I was their ally, and they actually asked us in not uncertain terms to just get out. Mm. And it became a completely different moment. And I remember this was very troubling in some, well, to me. I sensed that this was a different world, and that in fact, you know, they had become their own subject. In fact, you know, they could separate from being spoken for by Jewish intellectuals.
Yeah.
And so, yes, it was a traumatic. I mean, it was a very strong moment in my own history, 68 at the time. Oh. And actually, it actually distanced me a lot from both. I mean, I started being quite distanced from SDS, some of these guys whom I saw as very indulgent, or somehow, you know, it was kind of, you know, you joined the student left because you could pick up girls. I mean, I'm being very facetious,
sure.
but basically, and clearly it was so, actually kind of started to distance me in a weird way, maybe for good, because I really hit the books even more and became an academic.
Good for you. So from the perspective of 40, 50 years, how do you think it's turned out?
What now?
The civil rights struggle, where America is, how we've grown from that, what we still need to do.
Oh, God.
Realizing that we only have about 5 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it's a phenomenal success on some level. I mean, it's a totally different country. Some guy's running for president who is openly gay. I mean, you know,
right.
And it's not a big deal, which I find.
It's amazing.
Now, it's amazing.
Married.
And he points to his husband in the front row of the audience. And no one is. This is not. I mean, think about this.
It's a great thing.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
So, it's a completely different. I mean, women. You know, I literally never had a female instructor in anything, ever. Okay? Other than my elementary school teacher, Frau Kleefass, in my elementary school of the German elementary school in Timișoara, Romania. I never had a woman teacher, in Vienna, yeah. Columbia. I went to Columbia University, I had 5 degrees in the place, never had a woman teach me anything, okay? Unthinkable today. I don't think you can go to Columbia and not have a number of women's, including probably in all the sciences.
Right.
Okay. It's phenomenal. Where I think we are in nowhere near as good a shape as we should be as in race relations.
Yeah.
Which again, I don't have time now for less than 3 minutes, but that's to me is really still troubling. And it's not only the South, I mean, race relations. And what is very worrisome is that there is an increasing sense of kind of a very tribalized nationalism, which I fear. I mean, there's kind of a sort of the rural rage, the rage against elites, which is now, of course, weaponized by this president, and this is very worrisome to me.
Is this an aberration, or has this always been there?
Look,
not quite so inflamed.
I mean, we can go through American history. There were the know-nothings in the 1850s. Before that, the North thing, the Civil War. There is, you know, the 1890. I mean, it happens all the time. I mean, since I live now, this is worrisome, and I think it's worrisome because of the. And in this sense, I'm of course always a very, very classical Marxist, meaning that ultimately it's the economy and technology that defines everything. And with the, you know, changes to consciousness. And I've never, you know, Twitter is a completely new, it's literally a new dimension. Mm-hmm. We've never had a Twitter president. So in fact, the whole form of communication has created a situation in which sentiment can be weaponized literally in 2 seconds over anything. And so I actually am not quite sure.
It makes reasoned discourse very challenging.
It makes it potentially impossible. I mean, and the whole thing is sort of so new and so fraught with surprises that it's kind of, that worries me. In other words, if this were Donald Trump in the 1950s, he would be love to be in the 50s. That's what, you know, I would not be worried because, you know, the channels of communication would be controlled. Today it's not, and by the way, it's not only Donald Trump. Right. I mean, it's just any kind of response which has been sped up, and the whole notion of discourse is completely different by virtue of a technological invention called the internet and above all now Twitter and so on. So in some ways, all bets are off. And I'm still ultimately optimistic. I still believe that ultimately the Republic will survive. The Republic actually will remain a pluralist institution. It will, in fact, not succumb to any kind of authoritarianism in any meaningful way. But I'm more worried because the rage that it can be expressed literally with no threshold is ubiquitous, and that scares me.
On that note, I think we'll have to end this podcast, Professor. Thank you very much for coming to Charleston.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.